From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. Tracking down your team can be tricky if you're a Braves fan.
We've had folks that have shown up here like in the fifth or sixth inning and they're upset, they're fired up, if you will. And we'll say, well, you know, what's going on? They said, well, we got tickets to the Braves game, so we went to Turner Field. And then we got there and they said, nope, this is for Gwinnett.
That's Gwinnett Braves general manager North Johnson. Now, the team is getting a new original name to help differentiate it from the Atlanta Braves. Fans decide a winner today. That's ahead this hour. But first, last week, the Break Room talked about tantrums in the sky, in particular, how one toddler kicking another passenger seat ended with the entire family getting removed from a JetBlue flight.
I fully support JetBlue.
Absolutely. If they're taking donations, I would like to send one.
The parents are responsible for making their kid behave.
Okay, now that was Rule Joyner, Jessica Salagi, and Kathy Lohr. Here are your first thoughts. Kit Dobry writes to us, I was shocked and frankly appalled at the panel's responses to the family kicked off the JetBlue flight. I am so sick of parent shaming. As a mom, flying with my 18-month-old was incredibly stressful. He wanted to get up and move around the whole flight, even though I spent the entire time at the airport running him around to try to tire him out. I packed every kind of toy, book, and distraction I could think of to entertain him on board, and he still wriggled. I wrestled him to try to keep him from kicking anyone. He wasn't being bad, he was just acting his age. Thankfully, everyone around me on that flight was very kind and understanding and remembered what it was like to either have a young child or to be a young child in a confined space. We always want to know what you think. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the program. Atlanta City Council has okayed funding for a $26 million plan to combat homelessness. The United Way has pledged another $25 million in aid. This follows news Atlanta's largest shelter, Peachtree Pine Homeless Shelter, will shut its doors by the end of August. So, a deal has been reached, money is coming in, and the Peachtree Pine Shelter will close. That must surely mean that homelessness in Atlanta has been solved, right? Let's talk about it with Rick Westbrook. He is the executive director for Lost and Found. That is an Atlanta-based nonprofit focused on securing housing for LGBT youths. And Deirdre Oakley, she's a professor of sociology for Georgia State. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to have you on the program. It's Monday morning. We'll get there. So, Rick, let me start with you. What do you think of the deal? What was your reaction when you heard news of it?
I think it's a great idea to put money towards homelessness. Let's hope it goes in the right direction. To close Peachtree and Pine before something's actually in place is ludicrous. I mean, let's be honest. Where are these people going to go? They're literally lined up on the streets right now. Peachtree and Pine was not the most effective solution. It was run very poorly for several years, but that's the one place you knew you could go that you could get some type of service.
Are you concerned the money won't go in what you consider to be the right direction? What is the right direction?
Well, the right direction is actually talking to people on the ground doing the groundwork.
People like you.
Well,
perhaps,
yes.
You're doing the work.
Yes, we are on a daily basis. So, you know, it's 24/7, 365 days a year.
Yeah.
And we serve a very vulnerable population, but there's, and I'm sure my colleague across the table can testify to this, this problem is huge, huge. Mm. And the city really does not have their finger on the pulse of what's going on out there.
Deirdre, do we have do we know how big a problem we're talking about when we utter the word homelessness in Atlanta?
Well, there's a census that's done, and so we've got some numbers, but I would say they're probably an undercount. I think that the numbers in the article that talked about the United Way in the city, there were 3,500 people, which is, I kind of went, whoa, that's all? I mean... And then they had another number for people on the street and everything. But what they don't get at is hidden homelessness. Rick here deals with a lot of youth who end up sleeping on couches. But by the federal definition, they are considered homeless. The other thing is what people don't realize about Peach and Pine is I think there might have been a family shelter closed, that they had opened up the entire upstairs for women and children. And so when you talk about, well, you know, we're going to get housing for all the men who stay in the shelter, they're not talking about this unofficial population that was upstairs. The other thing that is keeping in with what Rick is talking about in terms of where the money is going, there isn't just one type of homeless person. There are many different cases, many different reasons why people become homeless. And so the services for them, shelter and other services, need to be catered to their specific needs.
Yeah. You know, Rick, generally speaking, is there a lot of empathy, sympathy for the work you do? People live busy lives. You know, there doesn't seem to be enough bandwidth to get through your day sometimes.
Oh.
And then to take on an issue like what you're taking on in a serious way, is there enough bandwidth in the society to seriously take on an issue like the one you're taking on homelessness?
Luckily, because of situations like this where we sit down and talk about it, where you know, we've got a person that's an active audience. Yes. Just goes to show you that the city doesn't know what they're doing. In the article she was referencing, it said 3,500 people were homeless. Georgia State did a count 2 years ago, the most comprehensive study that has ever been done in Georgia of homeless. And we know that there are 3,300 youth on the street on any given moment or any given day. Of which 950 of them identify as LGBT. So, you know, going in once a year and counting the people that's actually in a shelter is not doing the work.
If we talk about Peachtree Pine, was it time for that shelter to close? Give it a grade, Rick. How well was it run? How effective was it?
I would have to give it a D. They were starting to make changes, like you said, with taking in women and children. You know, there's really, I'm an old Southern boy. I can't imagine a woman and a child being out on the street. But I see kids disposed of every day just because of who they are. So there's not enough going out there. I think it was time, but you can't stop something without have something to replace it.
So that gets to the question of what comes next. Where will the homeless go? Here's a clip from a woman who used to live at Peachtree Pine. Her name is Bubbles, and this is from some reporting from WSB-TV here in Atlanta.
Pine is the only shelter where you can come in on a day-to-day basis. When they close it down, where are the homeless people going to go? We're going to migrate to the McDonald's, anywhere we can sit while it's raining.
Fulton County Commission Chairman John Eaves, who is also running for mayor, here's what he said about the news and the statement from all the parties involved. The only way this thing really works is if the people at Peachtree and Pine have somewhere to go. So, Deirdre, where do the people go? How concerned are you about the next step?
Well, I mean, that's an open-ended question. The article that was in the paper said that they're not going to close down until everybody has another place to go. But then it's kind of contradicted by the fact that they said it's closing down on August 28th. So I can't see how they're going to find shelter for all the people that are there by that time. And I think Rick is absolutely right that you can't close something down before you have a solution in place. And I also just want to qualify something that the Peach and Pine shelter has had absolutely no resources whatsoever for years. So when we talk about it not being run well and everything, I think we have to take a step back and say, hey, these are still very dedicated people who were working with what they could work with. And that goes away. Where do people go?
So which brings up, I think, an interesting question to piggyback off what Deirdre's saying here. Was the shelter targeted? Some suggest that maybe it was targeted by the city, by developers, because of its prime location. Negatively targeted in a way, Rick, I wonder if you agree, that made it very difficult for the shelter to raise the kind of money to provide the kind of services that were necessary.
Well, it is a prime location, so I'm not going to put anything past city and council. I hate to say that, but, you know, we're having trouble finding places to open shelters. When we started 5.5 years ago, there I could count at least half a dozen shelters in some form around that area. But the city's famous for doing stuff like this. A few years back, they closed Jefferson Place, which they're thinking about reopening. And they didn't tell anyone until the day it happened. And people showed up to deliver stuff, and the doors were chained shut.
Let me play some thoughts, okay. some feedback, get some feedback from some Atlantans on the need for shelters in the city.
Catherine Brosnan. I live on the west side of Atlanta. And yes, there should be homeless shelters all throughout the city.
Lisa Harris. I live in Atlanta, Georgia.
I think there's a great need for a homeless shelter in my area. I travel the expressways near there. We see people sleeping under the bridges. I see people sleeping all up inside Northside Drive. I've even in the wintertime had to run people away from abandoned houses. So, yes.
My name is Alexis Humphrey. I'm actually born and raised in Ellawood, Georgia, but I do come to Atlanta a lot. Not particularly in my area, but I think in general in Atlanta area, yes, we need a few more homeless shelters, quite a few actually, or at least a place for the homeless to go.
So our guest, if you're just joining us, are Rick Westbrook. He is the executive director of Lost and Found, and Deidre Oakley. She's a sociology professor at Georgia State University. You know, we got a statement from the United Way's Jack Harden. He co-chairs the Regional Commission on Homelessness, and he says these funds will be used to build some shelter space, taking into account the closing of Peachtree and Pine, but they will also be used to create approximately 500 new supportive housing units. We will also be funding medical and street outreach programs. And Rick, if this comes to pass, would that be a step in the right direction? Would that be a more holistic approach to the homelessness problem in Atlanta?
They need to look at the problem as a whole. She mentioned earlier that there's different types of homelessness. A lot of the people on the street have mental illness. Or drug addiction. We've got to deal with that before we're going to get them in stable housing. Plain and simple, the federal government's new approach is housing now, where I take a kid off the street and put him in an apartment. It doesn't make sense to me. I'm certainly willing to think of other alternatives, and I've traveled to Seattle. I've traveled to Portland. I've seen tiny house villages that work. I've seen tent cities that work. You know, give these people a safe place to lay their head at night and resources to get them back on their feet. And I think that's a formula for success.
I think that's a good place to leave it to in this conversation this morning. Thank you both. That's Rick Westbrook. He's executive director of Lost and Found. Also with us, Deidre Oakley, a professor of sociology at Georgia State University.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you.
And just ahead on the program, a new film shows one Atlantan's experience as a sex worker. But first, it's bye-bye to the Gwinnett Braves and hello to a brand new team name. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headlee. Atlanta has plenty of Braves, both players and fans. Some play at SunTrust Park and some play at Colray Field in Gwinnett County. Gwinnett's minor league team is changing its name. They asked the public for ideas and they got plenty of them. The team narrowed it down to 6 names and the last round of voting is today. You can see the finalists and where to vote at gpbnews.org. We talked about what goes into naming a sports team back in May. My colleague Celeste Headlee spoke with Sonny Mehta, director of Clyde Group Sports in Washington, D.C., and Joel Feldman, an Atlanta-based attorney who focuses on sports branding.
Good morning.
Joel, some names, some teams stick by their name, like the Redskins, no matter what, and then some seem more willing. Is there a benefit to a name that maybe some people don't like but has historical nostalgia?
Well, I think that there's always some goodwill stored up in a name. People have jerseys, people have nostalgia, people remember taking their kids to a game of a certain team, and a lot of people are resistant to change. And so taking all of that history and all of that goodwill and just starting over is a loss of some capital. But overall, there's a lot of good PR and marketing that comes from a name change, especially in this kind of case.
But, Sonny, is that because this is a minor league team? Is it a different calculation when it's minor league as opposed to, say, the Atlanta Braves?
Absolutely, I would say. I think minor league teams have been pretty successful. So far, you're seeing all around the country these teams change to these fairly bizarre, absurd names to kind of create a new identity to connect with the town that they're in, to A, separate themselves from what their major league team might be. I actually just experienced this as an El Pasoan, where the San Diego Padres affiliate, the Tucson Padres, became the El Paso Chihuahuas, and they are a wildly popular team that sells out almost every game.
And we, of course, got a name change down in Savannah when they lost their smaller team. They changed this to Savannah Bananas, which has ended up being really well. But, Joel, how much is that success result in ticket sales as opposed to somebody just wanting a T-shirt that says Savannah Bananas?
Well, I think that those are two sides of the coin, and both of them are very important. Merchandise sales allows a team to have scope far outside of a small geographic region where it could sell tickets. On the other hand, minor league baseball isn't always about the product on the field, especially because the team has almost...
You're implying that the level of play at minor league baseball teams is not up to par?
Well, even if it's good, if a player's good at minor league baseball, they're promoted. So a minor league baseball team really has almost no control over how good they are because they're really just developing players for another team. And so they have to find other ways to get fans to the stadium. It's about the overall experience more so than just the product on the field.
So, Sonny, how complicated is it to find a good name? We have this suggestion from Randy Vinson in Covington who says, we should be the Gwinnett Sprawlers. Let's play some sprawl ball. Gwinnett is one of the most sprawling counties in the country. They were Atlanta's first auto-oriented sprawl community post-World War II. So when you're weighing a new name, are there how complicated is that, should I say? How many different things do you have to weigh?
Oh, it's a great question. Honestly, it can go so many different ways, especially when you've got teams like the Washington Wizards, which have absolutely no connection to the community. And in fact, there might even be some. I know the NAACP got pretty upset with the then owner of the Washington Bullets with the name change. While it wasn't an alliteration, there was some KKK implications. So you'd think it's not a very difficult. You should be able to sidestep any situations like that. But, you know, the internet is a crazy place. You've got Bodie McBoatface. I know that the new MLS team that is launching in San Diego, currently their leading poll for their name is the Footy McFootface. So, you know, you kind of just leave it up to the internet at times and see where things are going
to
go.
Do you? Is that a good idea to leave it up to the internet? I'm not sure about that. We got a serious suggestion on Facebook. Catherine Napkina says, how about Gwinnett Buttons? It has much to recommend it. It honors a signer of the Declaration of Independence. That would be Button Gwinnett. It would allow a team to keep logos and letterhead that have just a B. They could play up sports tradition of buttons with team buttons and player buttons. The costume could be blissfully cool in hot Georgia weather with a red tailcoat, top hat, breeches, and socks. And this is not a jest, Catherine says. I suggest this in all seriousness. But Joel, does a name of a team need to be grounded in the community in which they are? Or should I say, how much does that make a name stronger or more popular when it is grounded?
I think it's a double-edged sword. The truth of the matter is these contests have been largely successful at getting interest in minor league baseball teams. Certainly,
you mean successful in drumming up outreach, not in picking great names?
I would say success as far as merchandise sales. If you look at the teams that are doing well in merchandise sales, you have a lot of them like the Albuquerque Isotopes, which was a team name that was selected by a contest. It's actually an homage to The Simpsons. An episode in which the fictional minor league baseball team in Springfield was going to move to Albuquerque and was named the Isotopes. So there is obviously some connection to Albuquerque and the nuclear material there, but really that was largely unconnected to Albuquerque. In Richmond, where the Braves used to be, you have the Flying Squirrels, which doesn't have a lot of tie to Richmond, but there's a lot of kitschiness there. So I think that one of the big considerations is, are people going to buy merchandise? Is this going to have a cool logo? Is it going to have a mascot that people want to interact with? And if all of those things add to the experience, I'm not quite sure that there's a lot of importance in it having a specific connection to the community. And of course, there's the question of, should it be connected to Gwinnett or should it be connected to the metro Atlanta area, if there is a connection to the area.
Right. But Sonny, are there certain kinds of names that we just aren't going to see anymore, at least for minor league teams? And I'm talking about ones that are named after Native Americans by any extension, or ones that are, I guess, really tough and intimidating, you know, like the Tigers or things like that. We don't see the Flying Squirrels, the Bananas. We don't seem to be seeing these names that are tough.
I think it's fairly safe to say that that's probably going to be the case. Those great names like Tigers, Bulldogs are falling out of tradition and what's popular now. And I guess I would push back a little bit on whether the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs are tough or not, simply because their bacon logo, for one night a year, they are the bacon, Lehigh Valley bacon, and their logo is quite intimidating.
But delicious.
Delicious.
We have a few tweets here. Edward Austin Hall says, the farm team should do what the Atlanta Braves should have done ages ago, become the Bravos. John Alvey says, leave my Braves alone. Minors or majors, we've had it hard enough here. Just let them be the Braves. Fair enough, John. And Michael Ruffin says, big chickens is too obvious, I reckon. So, Joel, in the end, for a minor league team in which merchandising often is where you might make more than ticket sales, is it always going to be a kitschy name that gets you the best? I mean, in that case, maybe the internet is the best place to go. Maybe Bodie McBoatface is going to sell a lot of t-shirts.
I think that is where the trend is of minor league baseball right now. That's kind of cyclical, and maybe in 20 or 30 years, we'll see different trends in minor league baseball, maybe sooner than that. But there's really not a lot of motivation for the Gwinnett Braves not to follow the trend of letting fans pick the name, picking something kitschy, irreverent, with a fun logo that's going to sell merchandise, that's going to have a mascot, that's going to bring people to the ballpark, that's going to have a mascot that can go out in the community and drum up interest, and that's going to get people like us talking about their name.
Yeah. Sam Burnham says, go with the Gwinnett Covfefe, which, of course, is the misspelled tweet that our president sent out last night. Sonny, in 20 or 30 years, are our minor league teams going to, you think, regret these kitschy names?
Probably. I think, you know, they'll look back and maybe they'll go back to their major league names, and who knows what even the system will look like. I'm sure the farm system will grow, and teams move around all the time. Just being in El Paso, and we had the El Paso Diablos switch around from three different franchises, leave the city, and then come back. So I think more than anything of it being out of favor or in favor, just minor league baseball changes pretty often.
Do you have a suggestion, Sonny?
Oh, I actually like the buttons. I think that it fits right along with sort of the motif that's going on, and clearly has this local connection that that might drum up local sport.
Do you have a suggestion, Joel?
I like the Gwinnett Fizz as an homage to Coca-Cola being founded in Atlanta.
Oh, that's not bad, too.
Oh, that's great, Joel.
The Fizz. Joel Feldman, an Atlanta-based attorney, focuses on sports branding, and Sonny Mehta is director of Clyde Group Sports. Joel and Sonny, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Celeste.
It's time we add two more tunes to our Georgia playlist. For this series, people choose two songs they think best represent our state. The rules are pretty simple. Nominations have to be songs written or performed by a Georgian, and musicians can't nominate their own songs. Lulu the Giant is a Savannah-based group performing at Brag Jam this weekend. We asked frontwoman Rachel Shaner to add a couple of tunes to our Georgia playlist.
I woke up this morning with my man. My name is Rachel Shaner. I'm the front woman for Lulu the Giant. And my pick for the Georgia playlist is, number one, the Freedom Singers. Hallelujah. It's one of their, like, main, you know, woke up this morning with freedom on my mind. It's a hallelujah. It's very Southern gospel, so. Back in the day, I loved them because they were huge in the civil rights movement and they were able to make connections and bridges between their music and the political discourse that was going on. So they, and their sound is just impeccable. They've got those harmonies and were a big forefront in, yeah, the civil rights movement. So. Well, it's got a super, you know, like I said, the Southern gospel feel, and having the lyrics also extend into just personal relationships. And, you know, it's never good to forget history, but it's great to be able to go back, hear that, and then see how they used music to influence their current state of affairs. And I think that music is and should always be a tool for that. Sound-wise, the vocals, the multiple harmonies, and some of the dissonance that's created, we try to incorporate vocal harmonies as much as possible along with the instrumentation, but they are an a cappella group, and so it's really nice to be able to hear their full sound without the instruments, and that's kind of how we develop our songs, is going from vocals, heavy vocals, and then incorporating the instruments to where it doesn't take away, but it's just enough to add. So I just love this song. I just love their song. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is Georgia Flame, Louisiana Burn by Payne Bridges. And she is actually a local Savannah musician.
He wrote a note asking for her hand. He didn't have a clue. He didn't make a plan. She fell so hard. She fell right in. Now they are apart. What's happening? The skies grew dark and the days lost light.
The song is, you know, jumping bridges, obviously, between Louisiana and Georgia, but she's talking about this love, and it's so folk and fun that it really brings in a lot of the sound of Savannah. Louisiana's burn. What I really enjoy about her is just she's got a really unique voice and she's got some really fun songs. But personally, that same air of like fun is in her songs. Even though it's folk and it can get really deep, she's able to keep just a joyful, in, like it's like a light around her, I guess. So it's always fun to hang out with her and then kind of get her insight on some things. So she's really cool.
Old, he can do no wrong, he only touches gold. The morning comes, she's still alone. She's searching for his arms, she's searching for a home. The skies grew dark and the days lost light. He stole her heart, took it across state lines. And now she waits and waits and prays for his return.
Georgia flame, Louisiana burn. Georgia flame, Louisiana burn. It's just really fun. So you know, going from some heaviness and then having you gotta add in some light songs. So that's why I really enjoy it. Yeah, I get to dance to it, especially with my bass. I play along.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
across state lines. Georgia's flight, Louisiana's bird. Georgia's flight, Louisiana's bird.
The sound of Georgia is definitely Southern gospel. That those roots are so deep and so encompassing. We have, you know, we're in the Bible Belt. We've also got our past with slavery, and so just these field songs, just to kind of go back and feel that heaviness and that truth and that and the way out. That is absolutely quintessential Southern sound.
That was Rachel Shaner, front woman for Savannah band Lulu the Giant. We spoke to her backstage at the Stopover Music Festival in March. They perform at Brag Jam on the Magnolia Street Soapbox Derby stage this Saturday at 7 p.m. And just ahead on the program, breaking down the stereotypes of sex industry workers. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, former Atlanta Hawks player Dikembe Mutombo. Can we even get him in the studio? We'll have to raise the roof a bit. He wants to buy the Houston Rockets. Dikembe's business interests also include his partnership with a company trying to offset the cost of sports for kids. Have you ever had to tell your child that they can't play a sport because it just costs too much? Give us a call. Leave us a message, if you would, please, at 404-500-9457. And be sure to join the conversation tomorrow at 9 a.m. For nearly a decade, Atlanta filmmaker Amanda Avery was a sex worker. Her experiences culminated in a short film called Leaving Charlie. Amanda wrote, directed, and starred in the film. She also made a point of bringing an all-female and gender-nonconforming crew to the work. Leaving Charlie is being shown tonight as part of a film festival by the group Women in Film and Television in Atlanta. Amanda joins us in our studio. Amanda, good morning, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, in the tease leading to this segment, we talked about stereotypes, right, of sex workers. Not the first time you've heard this question, but what are some of those stereotypes?
Drug addiction, you know, food stamps, too many kids, terrible personality, gross tattoos. I mean, I could go on and on and on.
Yeah. When did you start dancing? And tell me why you started.
I started dancing, I was probably 19 years old, and I had been working probably two or three jobs. I was living in Brooklyn, and I was trying to...
Okay, so you were in New York. Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's where I'm from originally. And I was trying to make ends meet, and I was struggling so hard, and I didn't have any time for my art. And so I met a girl who was a dancer, and she showed me the light. And I started dancing, and I loved it. It gave me the freedom to create art and to have time, and it was really special at the time.
Showed you the light.
Mm-hmm.
Explain,
showed
please.
Showed me the way. No, it was actually very casual. She was, you know, I mean, the way I remember it, she was lounging on like a chaise lounge midday, eating, you know, being fanned by, you know, palm fronds. And I was like, what do you do that you can sit around during the day? Because no one does that in Brooklyn. And she told me that she was a dancer, and immediately I was like, oh, I can do that. That sounds great. Take me. Immediately. And no one in my family was a dancer. That's not, you know, I didn't know anyone growing up who was
a dancer.
But
this was exotic dancing she
was
talking about.
Yep, absolutely.
And still you said, yeah, I can do this.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was...
Why did you think it was something you could do, something that was for you?
I was trained in dance. I'm very comfortable performing. I have a performing background. And she was just a person. She was just a person like me. She was very personable. And I was like, oh, I'm like you. I can do this, you know.
Mm-hmm. Why did you want to make a... I guess the first question is how long did you work as a sex worker? I think we just mentioned it. And ultimately, why did you want to change your life, and why did you want to change your vocation and become a filmmaker?
I've always been interested in film. I've always been acting, and I did some stunts.
So dance and acting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I have an arts background, and I've been participating in different types of art over the years. And dancing really just gave me the freedom, the schedule freedom. So it's not so much a change of vocation, but I did stop dancing for a little while. They say a stripper never retires, so I guess we'll see how that goes. But I did stop to make the film because I had the time, and, you know, I always identified as a starving artist. So with this money I had saved, you know, I had a comfortable amount of savings from dancing, and I felt inauthentic. So I spent it all to make this film.
Did you really?
And now I'm a starving artist again. I feel very authentic.
Why did you, I guess part of the answer to this question is they tell you, when you're an artist or a filmmaker or you want to write something, write about or produce something that you know, right?
Mm-hmm.
So tell me why you wanted to tell this particular story.
I mean, telling stories from a vulnerable place, human stories from a vulnerable place, is the way that we get past division and past stereotypes. And I have a unique perspective. I am a queer sex worker. It's part of my life. And I wasn't seeing people like myself in the media represented at all. Mm-hmm. And that's queer people, that's sex workers. You know, sex workers are not portrayed in a positive light. And so I had this opportunity. I had a tremendous privilege to be able to share my story. I have the means. I can talk about my work with almost no fear. You know, I don't have children that could be taken away from me. I don't have a job that I can lose. So I have this privilege, and I have a support network. So I was able to tell
the
story.
What does the title of the film mean, Leaving Charlie?
It's about the moment or the moments that I had over the course of my career when I was deciding whether or not to leave my character, to be there, to leave the industry, to stay with the industry, and how I came and went from the character that I had created.
Oh, this is interesting. Okay, so that segues us pretty perfectly to the first clip I want to play from your film. Again, it's called Leaving Charlie. In this scene, a man who, I guess, regularly goes to the strip club where your character works calls you Charlie,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the other women who works at the club asks about the name.
Mm-hmm.
Why did he call you that?
I told him that's what Charlie was short for.
Oh, make sure you make up like a fake real name.
They always ask. All my regulars know my real name.
What's a regular?
Like a regular customer? Someone who comes in regularly?
Making up the name, right? Why do you do that? It seems to me you don't want this transactional relationship, right, to become too personal.
Well, so...
Or am I wrong about that?
So in the second before, the customer calls me Charlotte. And so
yes.
Someone's making fun of it. And I was like, oh, that's what I told him. Charlie, my stripper name, is short for. And which, of course, is not my name in real life. And I... Almost every customer I ever had was like, but what's your real name? Like, I'm cool with you. Like, everything's great.
Because they wanted to do what? Break down the wall?
Yeah,
of that relationship?
I think it was more because they wanted to feel special. They're like, I'm not like every other guy. Every guy says, I'm not like every other guy. I don't usually come to these places.
And in the film, you respond to that.
I do. Yes, I talk
about
that in the film. I'm like, that's a strip club faux pas. Immediately. Every guy who says he's not like every other guy is exactly like every other guy. So I've heard that line before, essentially.
So in this next scene we're going to play here, your character has just finished giving a personal dance to a client.
Mm.
Personal dance, private dance,
mm-hmm.
one and the same, right? The client gets aggressive and your character decides to leave the shift early. That's when the club's manager questions your character.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think you're going?
Home.
In the middle of your shift?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I think I drank a little too much.
Can you pick up a shift on Monday?
Sure.
Part of the reason you made this film is you say people don't really quite understand what goes on in a club. They have, in a strip club,
mm-hmm.
misperceptions of what happens.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in a club? What are the challenges for a woman who dances in a club? One of the things you say is that harassment is an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Aggressiveness is an issue.
I think ultimately, it's not better or worse than any other job that I've ever had. It's just some people are better suited for it and not. And I think that for me, my personal hell would be being put in a 9-to-5 cubicle. That would absolutely crush me, like deep down, right? So, you know, while people have said rude things to me working and awkward things to me, and I've been in, you know, physically compromising situations, that's not the worst thing that could happen to me. But I really think the worst thing in the industry is that people don't understand what happens in the industry. And because of that, there's a lack of protection for sex workers in general.
Yeah.
And that's huge, and that's political, and that's every day. And there's a division, even in the feminist community, talking about whether sex work is a valid vocation or not. Women saying that other women are selling their themselves. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't sell myself. Myself is not a commodity.
I want to play one more scene. Mm-hmm. In this scene, a regular customer to the strip club breaks into your character's apartment and waits for her to arrive, and she's shocked to see him waiting on the couch.
Mm-hmm. I brought over takeout. You want to sit with me and have some dinner?
How did you even get in here?
I wanted to make sure you were safe. You didn't answer any of my calls. You know, you really shouldn't leave a key under the mat like that, babe.
Oh, my God.
So, you want to have some dinner?
What was this experience? Did that ever happen to you?
It did.
How'd you handle it? I mean, it's in the film.
Yep.
Do you portray it accurately in the film, how you handled it?
For the most part, yeah, I ran.
You ran?
I ran. I created a diversion and I ran. I've been followed home a couple times, but that's another thing. Just back to the previous point, going to the police is out of the question,
yeah,
pretty much.
What did you learn about yourself from making this film?
I learned that not only am I privileged enough to tell my story, but I can make myself a resource for other women who want to tell the story. After every screening, I have women coming up to me and saying, I worked in sex work and I never told anyone, and this is really beautiful. And people who have or have not worked in sex work want to know more, which is just tremendous. It's the best response that I could have asked for. So there is an opportunity here to continue telling the story, I think, maybe in an episodic format. People want more, and sex workers want more, and I can make myself a resource for women who want to tell their stories.
Amanda, it's great having you on the program.
Thanks for being here
this morning. That is Amanda Avery. Her film, Leaving Charlie, is being shown tonight as part of a short film festival put on by Women in Film and Television Atlanta. That festival starts with a reception at 7 p.m. at the Plaza Theater in Atlanta. Once again, a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
And the best with the film.
Thank you.
And make more movies.
Already happening.
Amanda, thanks.
Thanks.
To end today's show, join us for a bit of a jaunt. We're heading about 45 minutes north of Atlanta to White, Georgia. It's in Bartow County, about 3 miles off I-75. It boasts a gigantic junkyard. Now, from a distance, it looks like a forest preserve. But the closer you get, the clearer it becomes. It's actually a graveyard for rare and retired vehicles. GPB's Sean Powers drove up to Old Car City and sent us back this audio postcard.
It's Old Car City, USA.
My name is Dean Lewis. I've been to this place all my life. My mother and daddy started in 1931 with the general store. A few years later, I was born, and I grew up in it. I went off and got a job later, came back in about 1970 and added about 4,000 cars to my collection, and it became Old Car City.
50 miles north of Atlanta, Highway 411 USA, and here in Georgia.
Most of the junk boys or salvage yard, whatever, they sold. They sell as scrap and make more room and all. We luckily, we had enough room to save them, didn't have to sell them. And in fact, at one point several years ago, I was out of room, so I went and bought 26 adjoining acres, so that I wouldn't have to crush.
It's a rare old car. Let's go around this way. I want to show you a couple more things. My name's Rocky. Every day I find something new. 6 miles of trails and nothing but art and nature and old cars. We've got a few cars in here that people don't even know really existed. We've got a 1929 Singer. there wasn't that many of them. You're walking through here, you'd be thinking about the stories some of them could tell you. How many times people took off across the country, how far they went with them. Kind of like the pioneers, Clark and Luke, Lewis and Clark. Now here's an old veteran. I met him earlier.
Hey, lots of cars. How many cars he got in here?
A little over 4,000.
4,000.
4,000,
wow.
Ron Swope, lived in Ringgold, Georgia. Never stopped here before. My son.
Mark. Read about it in the Chattanooga paper. I live in Chattanooga. My name is Mark Swope. I know a lot about old cars, so it's just kind of interesting looking at all the old cars, like the design of them and all the chrome and all that.
Yeah, some of them we had, some of them we drove, some of them we was around when we were kids.
My name's Pam Clayton. I'm from Live Oak, Florida. My first car was an old Pinto. Saw one of those. My husband here, we were dating, he fixed it up and painted it, and we actually took it to the Netherlands and had it there for 3 years, and we actually left it there. So there's a Ford Pinto in the Netherlands.
My name is Marco, last name's Rossi, and I'm a photographer. I've found the first car that I bought 4 different times out here. I don't know if I can say this, I found the automobile I lost my virginity in. The first car I bought was a 1970 Grand Am. What I lost the virginity in was a 78 Caprice, a classic that was my father's car.
My name is Daniel Scott and we're from Marietta, Georgia.
My name is Katie Scott and I'm from Marietta, Georgia as well. It was crazy because we're talking about how my grandmother loves cars like this and she actually still drives like the more modern versions of these same old cars, and it was just amazing to think that back in the day, these are the kind of vehicles that she used to drive around in, and she loves to talk about them and everything that she used to have. And we've been trying to find things that she used to have to take pictures of to show her, and it's been amazing.
50 miles north of Atlanta, Highway 411, USA, down here in Georgia. Old Car City.
That story from Old Car City was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. For photos from Old Car City, just visit gpbnews.org. And that's our show for today, but we always love to hear from you. Have you ever found treasure, real treasure, in a junkyard? Give us a call at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Tony Harris. Have a great day.